It's Friday, April 2nd, and you'd be emotional too. We start here. Minneapolis jurors hear damaging testimony, including from Derek Chauvin's fellow first responders.
When I arrived on scene, there was no medical services being provided to the patient.
The defense has been that emotions were running high, to which several witnesses have said, yeah, because you were killing George Floyd in front of us. It could be a good jobs report, depending on what you mean by good.
They will probably not hire fully as they reopen.
This year's hiring sprees are going to look a little bit different. And if you thought COVID can't get worse, look to Brazil.
They can reach the most remote areas in the Amazon. They just don't have the vaccine to do it.
The man they call Trump of the tropics is now presiding over the world's biggest hot zone. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. A long trial usually gets wonky quickly, which is how it's supposed to work. A prosecution has to present not just a compelling narrative, but prove beyond a reasonable doubt that every single part of this narrative happened. So if there's a death, you gotta bring in lots of doctors. If there's a weapon, you got fingerprints and receipts and stuff. It's easy to get bored if you're in the room.
But we are gonna begin tonight with the searing new testimony in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd.
But in the first week of the trial, a former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, what has stood out is just how viscerally compelling every witness has been.
The young witnesses today, one just 9 years old, three teenagers taking the stand too.
Because this is the case of a cop, a crowd, and a man who died in front of all of them. And that sense of shock and horror does not even stop with people who were watching on the street. It extends to a lot of people involved in this case. And as week one wraps up today, let's go to ABC's Kenneth Moten in Minneapolis, who's been covering all this. Kenneth, can we look at some of the testimony yesterday? What did we learn?
Well, we know things were pretty tense on that scene when paramedics responded and actually tried to resuscitate George Floyd.
All right. And I think you just described this as you checking for a carotid pulse. Is that right?
We heard from them for the first time. They said that when they got there, they could actually see that he was not breathing, that he was unresponsive, that he was in cardiac arrest.
And while your partner was checking for a pulse and checking pupils, were the officers still on top of George Floyd while that process was going on?
Yeah. I noticed some blood near his mouth.
Okay. In fact, one paramedic said, I could tell that George Floyd was dead.
Did you observe anyone rendering any medical care or chest compressions when you arrived?
When I arrived on scene, there was no medical services being provided to the patient.
Okay. So when you got on the ambulance, did you do some further assessment of Mr. Floyd's condition?
They immediately just got George Floyd onto that stretcher and drove him a few blocks down and tried to resuscitate him. And then we know they weren't able to.
Well, and the officers, the case has essentially been, listen, yes, this guy died. Yes, he probably died while we were dealing with him, but it's not our fault. We had nothing to do with it. But you've even heard some kind of frustration from other first responders, cops, paramedics. Like, if somebody is dropping dead as you're dealing with them, wouldn't you try to revive them?
Yeah, they were frustrated that no one had given him medical attention beforehand.
Yeah, I was just going to call you and have you come out to our scene here. Not really, but we just had to hold the guy down. He was going crazy, wasn't going.
And we also heard from a retired police sergeant who was on duty at the time.
Now, sir, do you recognize the voice in that call?
Yes.
Whose voice was that?
Officer Chauvin.
That was the conversation, or at least his end of the conversation, as you recall it, on that day that you just described?
Yes.
And so when he went out to the scene to try to figure out, what was going on, the prosecution, they really hammered away at, what's the protocol for use of force.
And is the placement of a knee on a subject's neck a use of force?
Yes.
A reportable type of force?
Not necessarily.
And why is that?
They use them in that line of questioning to bring out information about Minneapolis police use of force policy.
Control is in, the person is then handcuffed?
Handcuffed and not continuing to fight with you anymore.
So once the subject is handcuffed and no longer resisting?
Yes.
At that point, the restraint should stop.
Yeah.
Police sergeant essentially said, restraint on Floyd should have ended once he was no longer resisting.
And so how does the defense react to all this? You know, these are prosecution's witnesses, so obviously they think this helps their case. How is the defense painting these witnesses?
Look, they're reminding the jury through their line of questioning that being a police officer is a dangerous job. And so they were asking questions to many of these witnesses who could speak on this, like that retired police sergeant. You know, what if a police officer was distracted by a growing crowd?
Can you describe for the jury what led up to that hospital stay?
Yes.
They're also taking the strategy, Brad, that George Floyd was on drugs at the time.
You later learned that that was due to an overdose?
Yes.
And that's what causes death, not the knee of Derek Chauvin pressed against his neck.
You did not know that he had taken heroin at that time?
No.
And one of the witnesses they pressed the most on this was Courtney Ross, the girlfriend of George Floyd of 3 years.
So that was yesterday, and things got emotional. It's been emotional all week, right, Kenneth? So what are the other pieces of testimony that you think will have stayed with the jurors as we round out this week?
It's been extremely emotional. Not only the words of these witnesses, these bystanders who were there as officers and George Floyd, you know, came face to face and as they tried to get control of him, but the video. I think it's the video that will remain with these jurors throughout this whole trial and afterwards. In fact, we had a juror, they had to take a break because she told the judge, you know, essentially she was having a hard time.
Would you tell the ladies and gentlemen how your viewing, experiencing what happened to George Floyd has affected your life?
And Brad, really what we saw throughout this testimony this week was the guilt these bystanders felt as they testified on the stand.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
They felt like they were helpless. We heard that word over and over again. I felt helpless. I felt guilty.
The highest power was there, and I felt like I was feeling it.
We're going to test that out by having you state your full name and spell each of your names.
Christopher Martin.
And that store employee at Cup Foods, who was part of the group of employees who had to call 911 when they thought that George Floyd, you know, allegedly passed this counterfeit bill.
So, did you think that bill might not be legitimate?
I did.
So what did you decide to do?
I took it anyways, and I was planning to just put it on my tab until I second-guessed myself. And as you can see in the video, I kept examining it, and then I eventually told my manager.
Christopher Martin actually said that he was hesitant for the police to be called. And in fact, even today, he's still getting negative comments from people about the fact that police were called.
We saw you standing there with your hands on your head for a while, correct?
Correct.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
And so it shows you that in the Black community, especially here in Minneapolis, where in that neighborhood, you know, is not known for being a good neighborhood. There's reported gang activity. There's other incidents that police obviously have had to respond to. And when it comes to these communities that are heavily policed, have high crime rates, there's a mistrust, there's a distrust of police, and these types of incidents don't help.
Yeah, the sense you got from people who were there was, no, I've had nightmares about how a situation with the cops could turn out, and this nightmare was coming true right in front of my eyes. Kenneth Moten, following the case, continuing today in Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thank you.
If 2020 was the year of a pandemic, 2021 will hopefully forever be known as the year we dug out of a pandemic. And that's not just from a medical perspective. That is a jobs perspective. That's an economics perspective. And if you're President Biden, you're literally thinking about digging out of this because he hopes this is also known as the year that he pushed through a massive infrastructure bill.
It's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It will create millions of jobs. Good-paying jobs will grow the economy.
So what exactly are we in for? What is realistic? Let's turn to ABC's chief business and economics correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis, because Rebecca, later this morning, we're expecting, you know, the monthly jobs report. What are we expecting as far as the economy right now?
Brad, expectations are very high for this report. The analysts' consensus, which is the average of what the analysts on Wall Street are expecting, is that we will have added 675,000 jobs in the month of March. That would be the strongest since we saw some of the reopenings happening last summer after, if you'll remember, the last stimulus package.
Lately, seen an uptick in reservations, particularly guests that have been vaccinated that we haven't been able to serve indoors.
This time around, you have a number of people getting vaccinated. You have a number of states lifting their restrictions, and that means people returning to work, especially in places like leisure and hospitality.
What does it mean to you to have capacity back up to 100% today?
Oh, it's great. I mean, I have the ability to serve more people, get more people in here. And, you know, it's just an overall good look for the restaurant.
We talk about this a lot. People who work in restaurants and bars, they're some of the hardest hit people because they've remained closed or they've been at limited levels. And as we see more and more of the country opening up, we're seeing hiring happening in those areas. And one thing that's pretty interesting here is OpenTable tracks all of the seating and the reservations. Well, in the state of Texas, things are back to normal, and much of the country is also really ticking up as well.
For the last year, they've held their weekly breakfast meetups outside, but not today. They made sure to dine in the very first day indoor dining was available.
It feels wonderful because it's cold out there.
Well, and when we talk about like back to normal, I'm wondering, like, if you're a restaurant or a gym that somehow survived the last year, are a lot of these companies still planning on losing money somehow through a lot of this year as people start to come back? Like, when is normal?
Well, a lot of these companies have had to pivot. They'd had to completely rethink their business.
More companies are planning on opening ghost kitchens, driven by how many of us are ordering more and more online.
It's a collection of restaurants and food brands, but it's for delivery and takeout. So there's not that on-site dining component.
And they will probably not hire fully as they reopen. Many of these places will bring back partial shifts. I talked to founders' restaurants. They're doing everything they can. I mean, these are like small families who work together, and they've been through a lot over this last year.
For the safety of her staff and customers, they are still social distancing and requiring masks unless you're eating or drinking.
Keeping our staff safe is extremely important. No one on our staff is qualified to be vaccinated yet.
But in order to sustain, many of the restaurants and small businesses are going to bring back half, two-thirds of their employees and wait it out and see what happens as they grow in strength. Also keep in mind, and this is something else we've talked about, they have bills to pay. And for many, they've not had to pay rent. They haven't necessarily made good on all of their debts. And now, as things return to normal, they will also have to return to making good on those payments with less help from government stimulus programs.
And so does that mean, translation here is, if you're searching the job boards, they are not the same jobs necessarily that you would have been looking at 2 years ago?
Not necessarily, but there's also opportunities potential in other areas. We're seeing places like construction, places like manufacturing are starting to tick up. And certainly this new infrastructure bill that we're now talking about could present some of those opportunities, especially in areas that pay much better wages than, for example, some of the service jobs we're talking about that have been lost in the pandemic.
It's time to build our economy from the bottom up and from the middle out, not the top down. That hadn't worked very well.
Well, right. And when we talk about this infrastructure push from the White House, it does sound like Democrats are on board with this. It sounds like no Republicans are so far.
And I'm going to fight them every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription for America.
We need a more robust investment. I have real serious concerns.
And it sounds like Democrats are split between how big they want to go. So I'm kind of curious, like, when you talk to economists, when you talk to Wall Street folks, what are they looking for, Rebecca? Like, is there a sweet spot where they're like, this is how much would get the country back on its feet? Or are they like AOC, just thinking like, yeah, let's go as big as freaking possible and that will juice everything else?
Well, Brad, it's a weird world that we live in today where numbers in the multiple trillions don't faze anyone in the way that they might have even 10 years ago, and they did. And that's part of the thinking.
No single government program is ever going to be enough to fill the 8 million job hole that was created in this deepest recession since 1929.
When we look back at the financial crisis and we think about what we did right and what we did wrong, one of the biggest pieces of consensus among economists is that they didn't go big enough at the time, that the stimulus and the relief that was offered in the wake of the financial crisis was not enough. Because if you'll remember, while billions of dollars were spent on the financial crisis, the country didn't get back to full employment such that everyone who wanted a job could have one for a decade. And if we end up in that situation again, where you have even more people out of work this go round than the last time, it is devastating for the people who are still out of work. And this is another thing, the longer you're out of work, the harder it is to get a new job.
Investors were optimistic after data showed a jump in manufacturing activity to a 37-year high in March and a drop in corporate layoff announcements to a more than 2.5-year low.
If you look at, for example, you look at the stock market's reaction to this infrastructure plan, for the moment, Wall Street is focusing on the $2 trillion that could flow into infrastructure spending.
And you have increased stimulus coming in the form of an infrastructure plan. So I think people are looking longer term with reopening, vaccines hitting almost 3 million a day, and using that as their optimism.
Right now, they're focused on the positives in the bill and the boost that it would give to business. But there's also the flip side, which is the increase in the corporate tax rate, which very likely at some point will make Wall Street more skeptical.
Yeah, which leads back to the question of whether this would even happen. Like, the stock market is responding. That doesn't mean that this bill is a sure thing in any sense. And if you're thinking about Republicans perhaps taking their cues from corporate America, what happens if corporate America says, yes, let's go big on this? So far, though, not nearly the 60 votes that President Biden would need to make this easy on himself. All right, Rebecca Jarvis, thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, our team goes to Brazil to learn just how fast COVID can spread if left unchecked. We're back after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
The current goal from the Biden administration is to get 2 million Americans vaccinated a day, maybe 2.5 million. Well, yesterday, we vaccinated 3.5 million. The rolling average continues to climb dramatically. This is happening for two reasons. One, states are expanding eligibility. Lots more people can get the vaccine. And two, states are getting bigger and bigger vaccine stockpiles.
You're really warping the speed now.
That is not the case in every country, though. At this point, the U.S. has vaccinated more people than Russia and China combined. We're far outpacing every European country except the U.K. And just remember, we also recorded more COVID deaths than any of these countries as well. Just a few months ago, the riskiest places on Earth, as far as COVID were concerned, were the U.S. and Brazil. And there's lots of reasons why these two countries were the hotspots. But health experts would say The leaders of these two countries had remarkably similar outlooks to the virus, to masks, to our overall response.
Brazil has two-thirds the population of the United States, but their daily deaths are rapidly catching up to the levels we witnessed here in the United States during the height of the pandemic.
We've had a leadership change in this country. We also got those 150 million vaccine doses on hand. In Brazil, none of that happened. So what does that end up looking like a few months later? ABC's Victor Oquendo has flown south to find out. He's made his way to Brazil. Where are you right now, Victor?
Brad, I'm in Sao Paulo, a normally vibrant, beautiful city. It doesn't feel like it today.
Yeah, what is the vibe when you go around Brazil right now as far as COVID?
Well, just this week, Brazil set a record for most lives lost in a single day to the coronavirus, nearly 4,000.
We have been doing this for a year now, and it causes additional stress, which is the stress of knowing that we are not helping everyone who needs us. The stress of knowing that when a patient leaves, I already have four, five, six, so many.
We actually went to the largest public cemetery in Sao Paulo. Grave diggers just can't keep up. They're digging graves from about 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. And while we were there, we saw three funerals. It was back to back to back.
Okay,
Kirita,
we get it.
Tell her I wish I could give her a hug right now.
And the people that were being buried, Brad, they were young. They were 22. They were 28. These are people in their early to mid-20s. Dying from this virus.
Really, we don't have enough space, enough beds, enough oxygen, enough medications for all these people with this variant that is very, very fast in the transmission.
And it's affecting more younger people now than it did a year ago.
Yeah. Younger people and children. We are also seeing children infected.
Unfortunately, that highly contagious P1 variant here in Brazil, it is spreading rapidly and it's definitely outpacing vaccine distribution.
So the Brazilian population, they trust in immunization. That's good. We have the capacity for immunize a huge number of people each day, every day. So what we don't have? Vaccines.
Brazil is the largest country in South America, and at last check, just over 2% of the population here has been vaccinated so far. They have a long way to go. The situation here only getting worse.
Well, and the big question, I guess, Victor, is why, right? I mean, is this just an issue of we're not vaccinating people quickly enough? Or, I mean, are there other factors down there? Like when you go out around town, are people social distancing? Are they masking? Does it look similar to the U.S.?
Yeah, here I am definitely seeing plenty of people wearing masks, socially distancing when possible. But of course, it's different if you get into a place like a favela. One of these areas where people live in very tight quarters, crammed together.
How tough is it to have to pay for testing?
And there, it's not so much a push to vaccinate. They don't even have access to tests. Tests cost money.
So the most people of the favela, they cannot pay for regular tests. It's impossible.
On average, a single test can cost about a third of what a person making minimum wage makes per month.
Can we talk about the politics of all this for a second? Because the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, he has been likened to President Trump a lot. Like they called him the Trump of the tropics for a while. They had similarly kind of dismissive things to say about the virus when it was becoming a thing. Both of them ended up getting COVID at some point. How has leadership affected what we're seeing right now?
They thought that I was completely out of my mind.
When you ask a doctor or one of his fired former health ministers what the problem is here, the first person they point to
Bolsonaro didn't want to hear, so
is President Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro once called the pandemic a little flu, and he's consistently ignored the advice of his own officials, going out on horseback and hugging children in huge crowds.
Who has criticized lockdowns, he's denied science, and lashed out at leaders who defy him.
They didn't make a contract with Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson, and the vaccines that were offered for Brazil.
With an upcoming election, though, he might be changing his tune a little bit here, because they're falling so far behind in the race to vaccinate. Now they're making a real effort to start purchasing more vaccine and getting it into Brazilians' arms. What one of the former health ministers told me was that Brazil actually has the capacity. They have a good system in place to distribute the vaccine. They're ready to go. They can reach the most remote areas in the Amazon. They just don't have the vaccine to do it.
Wow, yeah. And that's something that you cannot fix in just a few weeks. I mean, the Trump administration took months trying to get the resources together for a huge blitz on vaccines. We're finally seeing that play out right now. In the meantime, we see almost a vision, perhaps, of what could have been were vaccinations not as successful as they've been in the U.S. All right, Victor Oquendo, there in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Thank you.
You got it, Brad.
And one last thing. For the first time in a year, they're playing ball without a play button.
Deep and gone! Miguel Cabrera's 350th is a Tiger!
Yesterday was baseball's opening day. And most years, the major leagues try to start with one or two big games, try to hype them up.
How about that? On opening day
look
in
at the
snow-filled stadium.
But this year, games don't need to be hyped up. Rather than one player or one matchup, the most exciting sight to see is just the presence of fans, period.
What was that? I heard some noise. Oh, that's fans. That's great.
Last year, baseball was played almost entirely in empty stadiums. Clubs piped in crowd noise to keep it from being eerie. This year, the fans are back. They're yelling, they're cheering, but to some health officials, that is eerie.
Sanchez hits one deep to left field, going back. Gurriel looking up. See ya! A two-run home run for Sanchez.
Most stadiums appeared yesterday anywhere from 25% full to maybe like two-thirds. The Washington Nationals, though, had zero fans because COVID has already canceled one game.
Because of ongoing contact tracing involving members of the Nationals organization.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the spectrum, the Texas Rangers have said they will have no crowd size restrictions for their home opener next week, meaning you could conceivably see a packed house. Masks will be required, but President Biden told ESPN this is a straight-up bad decision.
Well, that's a decision they made. I think it's a mistake. They should listen to Dr. Fauci and the scientists and the experts.
And yes, these games are generally outdoors. Yes, lots of people in this country are getting vaccinated. But the people who are the most fully vaxxed in this country are, what, old people, sick people, frontline workers? That is not who's showing up to these games.
We're super excited to finally be open, have Yankee fans back, have the stadium open and bringing people in. We're really hoping it's just going to get better and better.
If there's a crowd of unvaccinated people gathering, it's not a big difference between that now and last August, except now, the COVID variants actually spread faster. The great thing about opening day has always been that for at least a few hours, everyone is undefeated. The question for everyone this year, on the field and in the stands, is how long will that optimism last? Still, though, I gotta admit, I love seeing people enjoying some peanuts, a beer, and a ball game. It is a sight for sore eyes. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therez, Josh Cohan, Ariel Chester, Lewis Millman, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Armando Garcia, Justin Gomez, Sarah Burns, Quinn Owen, and Eric Strauss. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.